Unfortunately, I regret to say I have no financial disclosures to make. No one has ever offered me any money for the work I do, so it's all gratis. So we only have 12 minutes each here, which on a subject of this breadth and depth is really impossible to do. So I really encourage everybody to take one of those pink sheets with them home, because there's a lot of good websites, including our website, that's listed there, and also the key points of all the presentations. What I would like to do is talk very briefly about the nature of the global economy, the nature of international trade agreements, why the market, the glorious free market, undermines workplace health and safety, and what's needed to protect occupational safety and health in a global economy and in trade treaties. And as I say, in 12 minutes, it's almost impossible to do all that, so I really encourage you to go to our website, where we have a number of reports that have excruciating detail on all of this. If you really want to know the ins and outs of it. We did publish a big report 5 years ago in 2005 about what's needed in trade treaties, and unfortunately 5 years later, the same things are still needed in trade treaties. So as many of you know, 51 of the 100 largest economies in the world are not countries but transnational corporations. The 500 largest transnational corporations control 70% of world trade, one-third of all manufacturing exports, three-fourths of all trade and commodities, and four-fifths of technical and management services. There has been, over the last two decades, a profound shift in manufacturing, particularly for consumer products in the United States and, in fact, the world economy. They've gone from, quote-unquote, relatively well-regulated workplaces, higher wage, often unionized plants in the developed world, to very low wage, basically unregulated, non-union plants in the developing world. And all of these plants, a plant in Milwaukee or a plant in San Diego, are competing with ones in Bangladesh and Indonesia for the maximum competitive advantage in production costs. So what you have in the world economy today are long, long chains, production chains, where you have international brands, the Nikes, the Disneys, the Toys R Us, all the electronics, none of whom actually make any products anymore. They contract with manufacturers, contractors to do that. All of the contractors have subcontractors, many multiple subcontractors. There are brokers and agents that are part of the chain, and it gets all the way down to industrial homework in workers' actual homes throughout the developing world. So, for example, Nike, which we all know, which is sort of the poster child of the sweatshop movement for the last two decades, has products produced in more than 700 factories in 52 countries. There's more than 600,000 factory workers, but not a single one of those work directly for Nike. The Gap has 2,000 factories producing their products worldwide. None of those workers work for the Gap. Disney has 6,000 licensees, 40,000 factories around the world. Not one of those people work for Disney. So on the other end of the equation, you have a tremendously vulnerable workforce. The latest or relatively latest ILO, International Labor Office statistics, indicate that there's 225 million children at work every day. There's at least 310 million immigrant or migrant workers, including 190 million in China, that are working outside of their region or outside of the country where they were born. There are at least 67 million workers in so-called export processing zones with few or no rights whatsoever. There are labor countries like El Salvador where the labor laws of the country simply do not apply in the EPZs. And then there are millions and millions of people, I'm sure some in this room, that are now temporary or contingent or permatemp workers in both the developing and the developed countries. You have at the same time, logically, growing inequality and deep poverty in the world economy. 40% of the world's people, about 3 billion, live on less than $2 a day. A billion and a half people live on less than $125 a day. And the top 1% of human beings on this planet have more wealth than the bottom 57% of the population combined. So the number of so-called least developed countries, that is countries that have a per capita income of less than $75 a month, has doubled in the from 25 countries to 49 countries in the period of time from 1979 to 2000. 80 countries saw a per capita decline in income over the 1992-2002 period, and the current crisis, as you might imagine, are making both of those statistics even worse. So you have the top six transnational corporations with tremendous economic and political power. Their revenues are greater than the combined budgets of 64 countries with 58% of the world's population. And these economic resources bring tremendous political power and influence. So in a nutshell, the global economy is characterized by a ferocious competition between corporations who roam the world in search for the lowest possible production costs and the most accommodating governments. At the same time, you have a huge labor pool of people who are so desperate for work that they are unable to refuse any work, no matter how dangerous or unhealthy. So, as a consequence, you can see in the global economy today, very long hours of work, very low pay, withheld pay, wage theft is a big problem throughout the world, unsafe and unhealthy conditions, physical abuse, sexual harassment, child labor, and a lack of basic rights. And you don't have to take my word for this, because there are literally dozens and dozens of reports that come out every year about what the conditions are in the global supply chains for any industry or any consumer product you want to mention. And this is obviously not a surprise to anybody, including Business Week, which last year had a cover story on sweatshops in the global information technology industry. The electronics, which has had sort of a buy for the last 20 years, is now squarely in the front of a world concern about terrible working conditions in the Dell and HP, Apple factories, which produce the products which all of which are dependent on a daily basis. Every year at Christmas time, there's a whole barrage of reports about bad working conditions in the toy industry. There's four big toy makers, one of whom you're probably not aware of. There's Hasbro, Mattel, Toys R Us, and the fourth biggest toy maker in the world is McDonald's for Happy Meals. And so that's all subcontracted. 80% of the toys in the world are made in China in very bad conditions. Also, the garment industry is sort of the gold standard for bad conditions throughout the world, and a report on Bangladesh. So that's what the global economy looks like. So how do trade treaties fit into this? And it's very important to understand that these are treaties that are being, put out to affect all global rules affecting everybody. Developing countries, developed countries, countries in transition, or however you want to say. So the trade treaties that we've seen over the last two decades are applicable to all. They're enforced by these unelected bureaucracies that have secret meetings, secret tribunals on who is or is not in compliance with these regulations. The treaties strip away national protections to achieve the lowest common denominator, and they place the interests of transnational corporations above all others. And this is generally, this economic model is known as neoliberalism, which we could have an entire panel on all ourselves. There have been, over the last two decades, some attempts to do, I would say, cosmetic improvements in the labor protection clauses. This started with NAFTA, which of course went into effect in 1994, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which has really set the model. But this model is that the regulations which currently exist in developing countries are the only ones that the countries are expected to actually enforce. And there is a complaint mechanism, or there was under NAFTA, their workers and worker groups could make that their governments were not actually enforcing existing regulations in their country. But there has been, since 1994, really a complete failure on the part of NAFTA to protect workplace health and safety. And if you go to our websites, we have several lengthy, excruciatingly long reports on this as well. These protections, quote-unquote, for labor rights under NAFTA were actually weakened under the Central America Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, and they've been weaker still in subsequent agreements. So that if NAFTA was a tremendous failure for protecting workers in Canada, the United States, and Mexico, the ones that have come afterwards have been even worse. And the part of the problem for this is that the market, which is what all these economic enterprises are functioning in, is a merciless enforcer of its own rules, which is that there's a significant number of low-road employers and global supply chains who unfortunately set the bar low and have an unlevel playing field for those employers that actually do want to pay attention to the rules and regulations. So the low-road employers have terrible conditions in their own plants, and they also generate an intense downward pressure on all employers. So you have a race to the bottom in every factory competing with every other factory worldwide. The governments in the developing world, particularly as part of these global supply chains, have limited or no occupational safety and health regulations. They have very limited financial, technical, and human resources to enforce whatever regulations they happen to have, and they're under intense internal and external pressures. And I want to give you an example of two countries that are probably familiar to people. Mexico has a foreign debt of $212 billion, which it has to pay $16 billion in U.S. dollars in interest alone. Now, they have an occupational health system in Mexico which is roughly equivalent to ours, but there is zero enforcement and there will never be any enforcement in Mexico as long as any policy that discourages foreign investment, which they need to pay the $16 billion a year in interest, cannot go forward. So if you actually enforce your regulation that discourages foreign investment, it's an economic suicide and political impossibility. So despite having an adequate occupational safety and health regime, no enforcement, and there will never be enforcement in Mexico as long as they have this debt and interest payment. China's got plenty of money. They have lots of our money. But the problem with them is that they have 24 million young people coming into the labor market every year. The population of Australia is only 22 million. So if you're the government of China, you have to find a new job every year for the entire population of Australia. So that means, again, any policy that discourages foreign investment, like actual implementation of your health and safety regime, is economic suicide and a political impossibility. Unfortunately, I'm about to run out of my 12 minutes here. So as I say, the market has a really bad effect, which you can read in these the reports that we put together. Let me just go to there's six things that we think, and obviously I can't talk about them in detail, that would be good things to have in international trade treaties which actually protect workers' health and safety. First would be a minimum floor for international health and safety regulations. What you have now with this race to the bottom is that the lowest common denominator becomes not the floor but the ceiling for any kind of health and safety regulations. So we need, based on ILO regulations, WHO regulations, the best practices among nations, to have a floor of regulations. Secondly, we need an upward harmonization, the way that the race to the bottom now, of course, it works to the other end. But we got to have regulations that stepwise over time get more and more health protective, not the other way. Thirdly, it's very important that the employers, and employers including the Nikes, the Dells, the Apples, the Gap, Levi's, are held responsible for what happens in their global supply chains because they're the ones that profit from it and profit very handsomely. Fourthly, there are only six, you need effective enforcement of national and international regulations and standards. And there's got to be some support from the developed world to the developing world so they do have the human, technical, and financial resources to make enforcement a reality. Otherwise, it's a joke. Fifth, transparency and public participation, both in the way that the treaties are negotiated and established and in the way that they have an effect on their countries. And then lastly, as I mentioned before, overcoming economic disparities and providing assistance from the developing to the developed world. So again, I would encourage you, everybody, go to our little website that's got lots of reports on this. And thank you very much for your kind attention.